Game on.
Game on.
2FM.
And you're very welcome to Game On here on 2FM. It's Hugh Cal with you until 8 o'clock tonight. We have Ronan O'Gara and Bernard Jackman on rugby in a few minutes' time. John Casey and Desi Farrell on the GPA's proposal for a new football championship. Jack Nolan will also give us his thoughts on Mick Nillis for Laois and to succeed Tomás O'Flaherty in the senior football job there. And Jeff Shepherd, all things USA. 51552 is our text number at Game On 2FM. If you want to contact us on Twitter, and Gary Murphy is with me in studio. How are you?
Very well, Hugh.
What a day for Paul Dunn.
Yeah, unbelievable.
8 under par, first ever professional round. I mean...
Yeah, crazy stuff. If Carlsberg did first rounds as a pro, I think that would be it. With a hole in one on 15, which is one of the toughest holes out there.
Mm.
And shot 64, 8 under par, and he's tied for the lead.
Incredible stuff, really.
3 rounds away from the 706,000 first prize.
Which would be more than enough, 3 times over to win his card for next season.
I'd say Collie might close the bar on Greystones if that happened, would he?
I tell you what, I'd be over to offer to caddy for him for the rest. I'd be gone out of here. Good luck, a night. Jimmy Mullen as well, who played with Paul in the Walker Cup. He also shot 800 today. It's the new brigade Gary's taken over.
Well, that's what happens with sport. I mean, obviously, it's, you know, you can wax lyrical tonight. It's only the first round, but an amazing start for both. And, you know, Jimmy Mullen was the hero, I guess, of the Walker Cup. Won his 4 out of 4 matches and opened up at 64 today as well. So, easy game.
Easy game, Gary. What the hell happened to you?
I just don't know, really. I was 74s more than 64s. And I left before I was asked to leave.
Yeah.
Or I went before I was asked to leave.
Yeah, well, we're all the better for it, I have to say. Wales just about beat Fiji in the end. They were cruising at halftime, and then Fiji did what they do and throw the ball around and play sevens with 15 men on the pitch. Brilliant to watch, but I'd say Warren Gatland has no nails left after a brilliant game of rugby.
Yeah, it was awesome. I mean, and it was a bit like the last day of the Six Nations when they had to score all those points. And you know, it was really exciting rugby. But you'd worry a little bit for Wales with the depth of their squad, because they're doing fantastically well, but they've taken a lot of punishment and still have Australia to come.
A lot will depend on the result between England and Australia this weekend. We're going to talk to Ronan and Bernard, as I said, in a few minutes' time. But earlier on, Michael Corcoran caught up with Dunica Ryan, Munster Lock, of course, who passed up a free pass to go shopping with the Carnies today. Obviously not into his skinny jeans in favour of a line-out session with Paul O'Connell. Have a listen to this.
Yeah, huge game. Italy, obviously, you know, all their chips are in. They need to win this game, and obviously so do we. We need to get through to the quarterfinals, so there's a massive carrot there for both teams. So, yeah, it's going to be a ferociously intense affair, and something we're really looking forward to.
In many respects, given the fact that we're both in the Northern Hemisphere, this is like a local derby, for want of a better phrase.
Yeah, we're very familiar with Italy. Obviously, played them over. We played in the Six Nations every year. In 2013, we didn't have the best result against them. In the last 2 years, we've done very well against them. But certainly, they're definitely a developing team. They really have developed from where they were 4 years ago when we played them in Dunedin. And certainly, they're focused for this weekend. We'll definitely right the wrong from that day.
And when you look at the last 2 weekends, you know, I think it's 30 out of the 31 players have either started or come on in some shape or form. But rather than patting each other on the back and saying, God, aren't we great, we've won 2 matches, you know, there's still a sense that there's room for improvement. I mean, there's still another couple of gears left in the squad.
Absolutely, and that keeps that edge in train that we have. If things were going so smoothly, we'd probably, as you mentioned there, we'd be patting each other on the back. But to be fair, we were very good, very, very well grounded, very fair in our assessment of the games. And obviously, it's good to have that confidence going into this big game that we've got going on this weekend. But at the same token, not losing sight that, you know, we're not perfect either. So certainly, that's what we're trying to iron out and train at the moment. I think training went very well today. And hopefully now on Friday as well, we can have things going smoothly as well.
And there is a sense that even though you've scored, 13 or 14 tries at this stage, you know, that there are still areas that need to be improved upon.
Yeah, I was hoping to get on the score sheet myself there now, but no such luck. That's a fantastic amount of tries to be scoring. The backs are doing really, really well. I thought, like, you know, obviously Zeebo's not try the last weekend would have been great to have gone through. But certainly, yeah, that's what we're trying to do, is build confidence in players as well, give the pass all the time, and be as creative as possible. And I think we're doing that as well. So obviously Italy would have done their analysis on us. You know, they would be disappointed with the performance they put in against Canada. I'm sure their training sessions will be a lot more intense this week. And obviously, they're as I said already, they're going to put all their chips in this weekend. So it's something we've got to be ready for, especially for in the first 20 minutes.
I know that you've played alongside and with Paul O'Connell for a hell of a long time, and you know the effect that he has when he plays for Munster, indeed for Ireland as well. I can only imagine that Sergio Parisa has the same effect on the Italian team.
Yeah, he's a fantastic player, an unbelievable athlete, and I imagine he has the same effect that Paul does have on us, minus the Limerick accent. However, he's definitely an amazing athlete, and someone we're going to have to be looking out for. And obviously, I'm sure the Italians will happily have the same mindset as us, is that, you know, they would probably look to target Parisa, but by ball carrying and that, and see how we get on with that. But he's definitely one to be watching out for.
It's also fair to say that the Ireland set piece scrum and line out is an area that's kind of seems to be functioning pretty well at the moment.
Yeah, it's good. It's something we've invested an awful lot of time in. Definitely at scrum time the last day, we didn't have our first scrum until the 33rd minute against Romania. But it was good to keep the ball and play for that as much as possible. You know, obviously fatigue sets in, and that does put teams under pressure in that area. However, I think when we did scrum last day, it was very, very good. Line-up the last day was fantastic as well, I thought, 100%, and the line of defence was good too. So, yeah, kind of challenge each other across the board to be better. There's a great synergy with guys. If one guy comes in, he knows exactly the role he needs to do, and obviously that's the way we want, that there's no kind of upset in the system that's been placed by the management.
I know there's a bit of downtime for all of us here in a place like Guildford. I drink coffee, but I gather you spend a lot of time studying the opposition lineup.
it's great crack. That's just the other side of it as well, and something I really enjoy. I love doing the analysis, and it's great to hop things off with Paulie and Dave and Ian as well, to see their viewpoints as well. So yeah, it's great. You know, if whoever feels comfortable with line-up plays, it's that's the one we go with, and what's best for the team, and that's what we're all about, is that working together, and so that we can kind of get the right options for everybody to make the line-up a success. So I do manage to get out and drink a coffee now and again, but to do a little bit away from the laptops. But yeah, it's a job that a line-up caller has to do, but a job that I welcome anyway.
Donnacha Ryan there speaking to Michael Corcoran earlier today. A bit of a problem with Bernard's line. We're going to try and get him up, but Ronan is on the line. Ronan, just listen to Donnacha there, and obviously you know him really well. It's brilliant to have someone like him back playing for Ireland after a pretty miserable run of injuries that he had.
Yeah, exactly. He's done it the hard way. He's a hugely interesting character, Donnacha is. I got to know him, I suppose, very deeply over the years. At the start, I kept my distance, but I think I really warmed to him. And feeling was mutual. He's hugely driven. He had Paul O'Connell's boots to fill when Paulie was injured, and that's the way the world works. You know, when Paul gets injured, whoever steps in has to do as good a job, if not a better job, if that's possible, than him. And that's the role Donnacha took on, and he embraced it, and I think that really gave him a kind of new status within the squad, and he grew as a leader as a result. And I think he's flourishing, you know.
Was that a conscious thing on your part to kind of keep your distance, or was it just the way things transpired?
No, I suppose I would have been obviously hard on young players, and I made them earn my respect, and he was probably distant, and he's a great man playing the clever clown the chip on the shoulder from Tip and the world against him, but he uses it as great motivation, and then everything came full circle, and he was obviously thinking of leaving Munster, and I didn't want him to leave Munster. And then once we kind of put the cards on the table, there was a great kind of bond between us, and I think that's really important, that you just strip everything down if you want to get inside a fella and get the best out of him. And I really enjoy my time with him. He's a very deep person, a great character, but would do anything for you, and that's all you can ask really of one of your generals, you know.
Yeah, and watch him on the pitch, you know, you see he's obviously a tough player and would do anything for his teammates, but then you listen to him being interviewed, and I heard him, I think a couple of weeks ago, talking about, you know, his studies, and he's into geology, and he thinks an awful lot about the game, so maybe what you see on the pitch isn't an accurate reflection of the person that he is.
No, but obviously, like, everyone has their, I suppose, rugby mask, and that's important to everyone, because once you step over the whitewash, we all become different, I think. But he's a very deep person. I think he's a hugely interesting person. He's great to have in a squad. He's has an opinion, which is very important also. And the most important thing is that he's a team man, and he has values, and he appreciates his values, and he's very strong in them. So once you have someone like that, I think he knows what he wants in life, and he's very determined, and he's gone about it. I think his parents have been great for him in terms of he takes huge pride in pleasing them, and that's, I think that's a great trait in a young person, that they're actually around to give huge pride to the people of Tip, people of Nina, and to his own parish, because he's a big GA man, he's a big Irish man, he's a big Munster fan, but he's a guy I must admit I found hugely interesting playing with.
Brilliant. Did you get to know Jean de Villiers well during your time at Munster?
Yeah, incredibly well, yeah. I would have had a fantastic relationship with him. Obviously, I was 10 and he was 12, and it felt like I played with him for years. Obviously, the season was turned around. He was left out of the European Cup game down in Perpignan, came off the bench, I think scored 3 tries and launched their season. So that just showed the professionalism, I think, brought it home to me. You know, a fellow that's left out, most people would sulk and blame someone else. Sean said he didn't deserve to start, and then all of a sudden he came in, bang, turned the game, turned the season, and everything was rosy after that. But yeah, I had my memories of him would be a great person. I had great times with him. He was a fantastic character, a fantastic rugby player, and we had unbelievable times together, more so off the pitch as well. I can remember himself, Nick Williams, Dougie Hollis were regular visitors to my house at 6 a.m. in the morning when I had twins on their way home. Hoping I'd open up a bottle or two. So I was up walking around my kitchen with 2 6-month-old twins, and it was a welcome addition at that hour of the morning. So, they were absolute. You know, I think when you retire, that's why you appreciate the game. If you think about, you know, the times I had on the pitch with Doug Howlett and John de Villiers, think about the times I had off the pitch as well. It's why you play the game, and it gives you such good memories.
Because I used to watch him when he went back to South Africa and managed to get back into the Springboks team. I used to watch him play, and an amazing player for so many different reasons, but it also struck me that, you know, the guys on the team used to just gravitate towards him. He was just seen like Paul in a way. Again, you can tell me more, just a natural kind of leader that people just, you know, went to for decisions and went to for his advice, you know.
Yeah, I think too, the important thing about that is that that role, I think, happens. It doesn't create itself, if you know what I mean. I think that's what makes people like Paul O'Connell stand out. I think Brian O'Driscoll had that aura as well about him. And Jean de Villiers, you know, it's incredible to think the impact he had for a fellow that was in Munster for 12 months, because there's been a lot of good players in Munster over, I suppose, 2000 to 2010, but he was one that just kind of made an impact. And sometimes it necessarily wasn't what he did on the pitch. He was excellent, obviously, at times, but I think there was something about his personality that made him really warm. And I think if you did a poll of the players, he'd be hugely popular.
Yeah, okay. Brilliant to hear. There's a very real possibility that England could be out of the World Cup by Saturday night. I mean, it makes what's already a very interesting game even more exciting against Australia. What do you think of England last weekend, Ronan, and how do you think they're going to fare against Australia?
I think they're sick this week. I think it's a game they had probably 9 chances to put away, but they didn't, and I think they're hurting and the pressure on them is immense. But I think a sport has taught me, I think when your kind of head is pushed underwater for that length of time, the hurt they'll be feeling, I think there has to be a positive reaction. I think there will be a positive reaction. My only fear is I couldn't think of a worse team in the world to be playing, with all the history between the Aussies and the English in terms of all sporting events. If there was a team that wanted to bury the English, it would be Australia.
Yeah.
Because they'd look upon them as threats for the title overall, and if they can get rid of them at this stage, I think it's a big step for Australia. I think with the fear and with the hurt in the English camp, I think they'll get a result on Saturday night. My God is telling me that.
The Australian back row, obviously well documented, Pocock and Hooper are brilliant on the ground. And we had Conor Shea on last night talking about Chris Robshaw, and I asked him how he felt, and you know, Conor was saying he was obviously absolutely sick over, but had to just park it. He's going to have a really big night on Saturday night, regardless of whether he wants it or not, Ronan, because those two lads are going to keep him as England 7 occupied for a long, long time.
Yeah, you're right, Hugh. And I think obviously everyone has jumped on Chris Robshaw's back. But to be fair, like, I think it was his 40th time, I think, captaining England, and obviously a big, big hiccup in terms of not kicking at the post the last day. But everyone is entitled to an error like that. I think what would frustrate people would be if he backs it up this weekend with another kind of leadership error. Everyone gets it wrong once, there's no problem. It's the reaction over we'll be interested to see. But in terms of, I suppose, tearaways, you couldn't be coming up against two better players. I think obviously if you were to design a prototype for a number 7, Pocock is ideal, and Hooper just seems to be extremely rugged and aggressive and a little bit kind of aloof in how he plays the game nearly. So incredibly difficult to shift from the ball. So it'll be interesting to see the tactics from England. Will they actually allow rucks to happen, or will they just target the two players before there is a ruck?
Yeah, I can't wait for it, I have to say. I'm also looking forward to see what Italy team turns up on Sunday. We're hearing that Parise's back, which is obviously massive, as Donegan Ryan mentioned there. But, you know, you've had your fair scraps with Italy over the years, Ronan, and you've dug Ireland out of a few holes on a few occasions. How do you see it going? How do you see Ireland coping with Italy? I mean, should they win pretty comfortably?
I think so, Hugh. I think people are looking to probably, you know what I mean, find fault with Ireland. Ireland are flying. I think it's great. I think we've moved to a new level under, you know what I mean, an unbelievable coach. And I just think how polished we are around ruck time. People are looking for the offload game all the time, but you can't have that. You look at the first 3 minutes of Ireland, Romania, and how we started the game and owned the ball. I think that just epitomises what the team is about, the direction that they have and the confidence they have in retaining the ball. Ireland give up very few points. Obviously, they'd be sick with giving away the last minute try, but game over, you know. I think the control Ireland exude now, I think, is hugely promising. It's very hard for teams to score against Ireland, and Ireland, unless obviously panic sets in or the pressure sets in, which I don't envisage this weekend or next weekend, we are a team that gives away a minimal penalty. So where do the scores come from? Because Ireland controlled the ball, I think. You know, we saw Johnny's kicking game against Canada, so there's a mixture of both available to us. So for me, I think it's very hard to see how Italy can prize an opening into the game.
Yeah. Simon Zeebo was brilliant last weekend. Keith Earls was brilliant last weekend. Watching the two of them together, just it was like a couple of mates who were just on the pitch for a bit of crack and just enjoying themselves. It just was brilliant, you know, the chemistry between them.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, that's good to see, because obviously sometimes when your head is stuck inside it as much as I would be and haven't played with them and kind of, you know, you'd have a different opinion. But that's exactly what it felt like to me as well. I think, you know what I mean, the bigger the stage, Zeebo just loves it and craves it. Yeah. And he feels, you know, that after Ronaldo, he's the most important sportsman in the world. So that's what makes him tick, and that's important that he has that. And Keith Earls obviously would be probably the opposite of that. Probably he's so humble, he'd just be very, I'm not saying Zeebo's cocky by any means. I think he is has his pitch exactly where he needs to be in terms of self-confidence, because people read into that knowing they don't mean it in that way. But I think Keith obviously would have struggled in terms of confidence and self-confidence for a while, but now I think he's getting to the level where we've seen in training for years. This guy is incredible, you know, and I think, as I said previously on this station, that there's more to come.
Yeah. The papers tomorrow, the headlines: O'Gara says cocky Zeebo is better than Ronaldo. Will you see them pick it up? Look, we're just out of time, okay, we'll leave it. So you think actually that England are going to beat Australia, and a comfortable enough win for Ireland this weekend? They're the two big games.
Yeah, I think so. I just think that England were so much in control of the Welsh game. I think they did an awful lot of things well. I think if they rectify not killing the game, in terms of they had opportunities to kill the game and go to 10 when they were 10 points ahead, if that goes to 17, it could be an absolute riot in terms of how they went on to win the game. But they didn't do that, and that comes back to bite you. But I think they will put a massive emphasis on their maul and on their scrum, and I think Farrell will kick penalties, and if it takes 10 penalties to win, they'll take that.
Yeah, okay. Great stuff as always, Ronan. Thanks, Liam. Enjoy the weekend.
Cheers, you. See you.
Sound. Thanks, Liam.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks a lot, Ronan O'Gara. There, interesting stuff. You know what? Obviously, it's a weird relationship we have with England. Obviously, in sport, and we never ever root for England to win. Doesn't matter who they're playing, but in a weird way, because they're the hosts and because so much revolves around English fans buying into this tournament to make it what it is, I kind of want to see them stay in. I'd
always shoot for England against Australia. The Aussies are more arrogant than the English are.
That's true. That is very, particularly sport.
Oh, they're unbearable. I mean, we hang out with a lot of them on tour, and you know they really are, and that's why they do so well. And I think Ron is dead right what he says about Zeebo as well. Like, you have to have that personality, because he's in a position on the pitch where you have to express yourself. But no, for the home nation to go out this early in the World Cup would be a disaster.
Yeah. Okay.
Game on. 2FM.
Now, John Casey and Jack Nolan are on the line to discuss, well, developing news in Gaelic games in Mayo, of course, and also in Laois. You're both very welcome, lads. And John, I just want to start with you if I can, because there is a meeting scheduled to take place in Mayo tonight between the county executive and the players. This has been down for a long time, and I'm wondering, is it still going ahead?
Yeah, from what we gather down here, Hugh, it is. It's at a location unknown to everybody and at a time unknown to everybody. So I don't think the county board were too forgiven with their timing, because a lot of interest, of course. But this was a meeting, Hugh, were originally scheduled to take place anyway. Mm-hmm. It was to be a review of the season held between the executive of the county board, Mike Kennelly, of course, brother of Noel, and Vincent Neary, the county treasurer, secretary, I should say, with the players' representatives, of course, being Keith Higgins and Killian O'Connor. So how that meeting goes down tonight, I don't think they'll be doing much of a review of the season, to be honest with you on it.
Yeah, I mean, it has to be about the events of the last week and the vote of no confidence in the managers and the conduct of the players. I mean, as the week has gone on, John, I know we spoke about this earlier, as the week has gone on, is there more an opinion on who's right and who's wrong here in Mayo?
I honestly think there's no winner in all of this, Hugh. I was just trying to analyse the situation, and I can see from both sides, you know, who to feel for, and who it's a terrible situation. You know, the likes of Pat Holmes and Noel Kennelly, obviously as managers of this team for the last 12 months, in fact, but, you know, serious level for the last 9 months, they obviously feel betrayed by the players. On the other hand, the players are very ambitious types of human beings. They maybe see that they've one last chance to try and get over the line. They mightn't have seen the boys as the ideal people to try and get them over the line. I have no doubt when that vote of no confidence was passed over to Pat Holmes and Noel Kennelly by the aforementioned Keith Higgins and Killian O'Connor last Sunday night, that this was the last thing that anyone expected, was this to be in the press and in a national story. It's unfortunate. We're being dragged through the mire again for the wrong reasons. But, you know, who's right and who's wrong in all this? There's going to be a sour end in it all, Hugh.
Yeah, and I suppose because it was leaked, John, and because of the figures that were out there, 27-7, yeah, you know, in favour of this no confidence, that, you know, you just have to say the manager's position is just really on thin ice. Whether or not you believe they deserve to be treated like that, it looks like it's almost untenable, really.
Well, as I mentioned to you on Tuesday night, I think it's untenable. Now, there is, as you mentioned there, the story being leaked, but it's, you're probably well aware that it's also been leaked that the certain players, it said seven players voted in favour of the management. I mean, four of them names have gone out in public now, which is getting the situation even messier. So there's somebody leaking information, Hugh, to a local publication here. Some top players named in that as ones of the seven. So I can only imagine all parties are fuming on all sides. Where it's going to end is anybody's guess. I'm sure Keith Higgins and Killian O'Connor tonight, if they're having a meeting with the executive of the county board, will probably offer the reasons why there was a vote of no confidence, whether that is accepted, whether Pat and Noel decide, look at here, enough is enough. If we haven't got the backing of the players, we're wasting our time. Will we just throw our hat at it and give up on it? But if they dig their heels in, it's going to get messier and messier.
Jack Nolan is also on the line, as I mentioned, GAA journalist and commentator. And Jack, you must be listening to this in Laois and thinking, hey, I think things are pretty good in my county compared to what's happening in Mayo.
Well, as you even though Hugh, we've had a lot of drama in the past, but no such drama at this occasion, you know. It really is it's a messy situation up there, there's no doubt about that. You know, one of the top three teams in the country, in turmoil at the moment, after what most people see is a very, very successful year, just missing out on that All-Ireland yet again. And maybe a little bit of a push forward, but you would imagine maybe this isn't the way to do it.
Yeah, okay. Well, look, let's talk about Mick Lillis then, because, I mean, I'm of the understanding that it's pretty much a formality now that he's going to be appointed as the new manager's successor to Tomás O'Flaherty. Is that right, Jack?
Ah, yeah, that would be the situation. Normally in Laois, the executive came up with the name and they put it forward to the full meeting of the county board, which involves all the clubs next Monday night, and that would normally be a rubber stamping job, yeah.
Okay, so look, Mick, minor manager last season, you know, so much experience across all levels, underage in particular as well, Jack. How will this go down? Is it a popular appointment, do you think?
Well, you see, you have a situation, I suppose, like in most counties, it's like Manchester United, I suppose, and ABUs and all this, but in Laois, anybody with Port Laois, it would be something that pertains out there among a lot of clubs. You know, you could point end at Cheddar Plunkett and see how successful he has been with the hurling end of it. But Mick Lillis is, you know, there was three people from inside the county. There was Joe Higgins, Leo Turley, who's now living in Meath, and Mick Lillis in for the job. They were nominated, they were interviewed. There's a number of outside names touted. And if you looked at it, suppose, from an internal point of view, there is nobody more qualified or more experienced than Mick Lillis. I mean, he played football with Clare, he played football with Laois, he won an Ireland club title with Port Laois back in the 80s, and he's been a successful manager in Carlow, club manager, winning Carlow titles, winning Kildare titles with St Lawrence's, and winning twice with Port Laois. He won back in the early 2000s. Won a title, went to the Leinster final, and then completed three in a row just 2 years ago. So he has a huge successful record behind him. And then last year stepped into the minor job, I suppose, but nobody wanted it, and were very, very unlucky to be beaten by Clare with a late goal in the Leinster semi-final. So, you know, he certainly has the pedigree and the credentials for it. And, you know, I think it's a matter of the county and the players and the club rowing in behind him now.
And do you think they will? I mean, it's a big job for a lot of different reasons, just to try and get Laois football back to a consistent level of competitiveness, I suppose. But even just, you know, to make Laois fans passionate about their county team again and get more people into a Moore Park when there is competition there.
Well, that is the problem, Hugh, because I suppose things were never at such an all-time low, probably, in Laois. You know, the numbers going to games has dwindled, you know, so back to the heady days of Mickle back in 2003 and all of those, and three Leinster finals in a couple of years. And the crowd has certainly dwindled away, and it's probably true to say over the last, say, a month or 2 months, more people have attended the local hurling championship matches than the football games. So there is a lack of interest there. There also has been, you know, very little underage success for maybe the past 7 or 8 years. Very few players coming through of that caliber. So he has a huge job on his hands, you know. But I think he's a man that's up for it. I believe he has a very strong backroom team in place. The names aren't out yet. He's put an awful lot of work into it. And you know, he's a man who can deal with players. Good manager, good man manager. And I think he'll do very, very well. You know, from the base that Laois are at and the low base at the moment, talks of bringing in somebody from outside and, you know, some of the real high-profile managers, I don't think they were queuing up for the job. And I think when a man like Lillis wanted it and is passionate about it, he's probably the right man for it.
Absolutely. And in one sense as well, the only way is up now. So we wish him all the best, and we're going to talk about it. Stay with us if you can, lads, because I want to get your view on the GPA's proposal to revamp the football championship as we now know it. Desi Farrell here has been talking to Jackie Hurley today on why they decided to bring this proposal now, the timing of the whole thing. Have a listen.
We just think the time is right to do it now. The GAA are obviously undertaking a review of competition structures, and we contacted them and they said they'd be very happy to accept a proposal from the GPA on behalf of players. So we feel the opportunity is there and the time is ripe to actually put forward a set of proposals that could make a profound and positive impact on the game.
What are you hearing back from your members?
Well, we've been hearing this for a number of years now, that there's growing levels of discontentment with the football structures. But it is a complex area, and many different players and many different squads will have various views as to what the best format is. So it's been a challenge trying to build consensus around a set of proposals that we could bring forward. But we're confident now that we've got to a place where we have proposals and an alternative model that's built on a really strong consensus amongst the playing population.
What was the most important thing for you guys to get out of this new structure?
There was a couple of key elements in terms of change. One of those was that the playing experience needs to be enhanced, a better quality playing experience for players. And that's not just at county level, but also at club level as well. So these proposals add some structure to the county game, but also provide a really big window for the club game to thrive and flourish as well, which was really important. There are other elements then, such as the games to training ratio, and the burning issue for players, too much training, not enough high profile games. So that's been adjusted as well. More high profile games in a condensed period of time. There's also important elements such as the fan and supporter experience as well. So obviously more action, more engagement, more interest, more appeal. That has a knock-on effect commercially as well, so we believe there'll be huge implications, positive implications for the GA on a commercial level centrally, but also a county level as well. Player welfare is a big important part of it, so we've built in rest and recovery periods throughout the programme as well.
I notice even just from reading through the notes that you're saying 85% of squads already are coming back and saying they're in favour of this. Is it the structure itself that they're kind of very happy with, or is it the rest periods that you're talking about? Like, you say they want games, but I'm assuming this idea of a Champions League structure, they're still going to get a lot of high-profile games, and maybe is that what they're looking for?
Players love to play the games, and we've all been there and we've all experienced that, and it's about playing the games. That's where there's most enjoyment. So definitely the inclusion of more competitive, high-profile games was really important. What was important in that too was that the so-called weaker teams, or those teams operating in the lower divisions, that they were given the opportunity to pit their wares against the best in the game as well. So the idea of a second tier competition for those counties just wasn't a runner, and they were really strong in their feedback in relation to that. So more games, more interest, more activity, condense the season and have very definite pre-season and close season periods, and I think overall just enhances the quality of the playing experience for both county and indeed the club players.
That's Desi Farrell there speaking to Jackie earlier today. John Casey and Jack Nolan are still with me. Lads, I mean, John, I've had a good read of this now. I've listened to Desi's interview with Jackie, and I can't see a downside to this. It seems to cover everything. What's your own view?
Yeah, well, indeed, I'm the same, Hugh. I was trying to get my head around it. Indeed, I suppose it's the type of structure that until you see it put in practice, you really won't know how successful it will be. Mm-hmm. I'm presuming with the way Desi and the GPA have it set up that the league will be run off, we'll say, February and March. And then I think that, from what I gather, they want to have the provincial championships played off by mid-May.
Yeah.
Now, that'll be a lot of games to play off, we'd say, if the likes of Ulster, Leinster, I mean, Connacht, my own province, wouldn't be so bad. There's not as many teams. So it'll be interesting from that point of view to see how many games. I know they want to increase the games to train and ratio. They want to tighten up the calendar year. I'm just wondering in all of this where the Sigerson Cup is going to come into it. We can't, you know, it's a medal that everybody loves to win, as the Sigerson medal. How is that going to incorporate into all of this? But certainly I'd be in favour of a process, Hugh, that doesn't leave players waiting 5 or 6 weeks for football matches. That's the worst case scenario in the summer months, or even this year Mayo played Galway in the championship in Salt Hill. Galway had two games played. I mean, and we've only 7 teams in Connacht. Galway had played two games by that time. So it's If the process works, and you know, on paper it looks really, really good, I have to say.
Jack, I mean, in terms of the potential negative feedback and things that the GPA have obviously worked long and hard around this, and they've taken a lot of feedback from the players, but it protects the league structure, it protects the provincial championships, which was a key element, I think, for a lot of people, and it doesn't provide for a second tier competition, which the players themselves say they don't want. So it seems to tick an awful lot of boxes.
Absolutely. I mean, everybody agrees, I think, that change is needed, because it's what's there at the moment is just not working. It's not fair. It's gone too lopsided. The gap has grown too much. I mean, you just take Leinster. The gap between Dublin and the rest is just absolutely huge. Mm. There's probably 3 tiers or maybe 4 tiers in Leinster alone. And, you know, some teams are getting awful hammerings. You also have the problem of the long breaks, where you have 5-6 weeks of a break. But even in that 5 or 6 weeks of a break, most counties don't allow their players back with their clubs. So the clubs are suffering as well. So to get a system that gives parity to everyone, gives everybody fair play, with regular games, but they were also bringing the clubs into it, that the players, either the clubs acting suffering as well. I think this is, I haven't looked at it in all of this detail yet, but it certainly looks to be good. They'd be ticking a lot of the boxes, and you know, maybe with a bit of tweaking and with an input from everybody, this could be well something that could work.
I mean, you know, from a commercial perspective as well, John, as Desi said there, I mean, there's going to be more high-profile games, there'll be more attendances, more commercial interest around that. From a financial point of view, it would certainly make sense. I mean, there's very little that I can find against it. And even we had Dave Gilligan with us last night on the club scene about Dublin players only really starting the county championship now because Dublin are out of the All-Ireland. I presume it's the same with Mayo clubs there having to wait until they're out. So, I mean, it seems to benefit everyone.
Seems to benefit everybody, and that's just, I suppose, the club players are the grassroots level are what you want to protect. But I certainly would have spoken to, I mean, the two-tier thing, I'm glad I've been hearing on this about two-tier championships for the last 5 or 6 months, because we had, particularly this year, we had a lot of drubbins, and I'm glad we're not going down that route. I mean, in England, for example, with the FA Cup, everybody gets a chance to win the FA Cup, no matter how good or bad you are, what division you're playing in. So I was speaking to some Sligo footballers, for example, in the last couple of months after, you know, they were humiliated by Mayo, and the first thing they want to do is get on the field again against Mayo to show people that they're better footballers than they are. So if there was a two-tier thing, that would be wiped out the door. So we keep saying it looks really good until you actually put it in practice for a year to see how the clubs are suited, to see how the clubs fit in to the whole structure. It would mean quite a lot of inter-county games, and there wouldn't be very many breaks, I'd imagine, in between. If you've got, as I mentioned earlier, if you've got to play provincial championships and have them run out by mid-May, and then you go into your Champions League structure of eight groups of three. The only ones, you know, the minnows, as I call them, it would be interesting to see if they had a bad run early on in their championship. How would they hang around for their 5 or 6? There still could be a 5 or 6 week wait until this group stages are picked. Mm-hmm. And they would have a weight. So how that is tied in, it'll be interesting to see.
Jack, do you think that it's likely the GAA will give this serious thought, or do you think that it's something that ultimately is not going to happen, it changed for a long, long time?
I think they will at this stage, because I think there has been a lot of disquiet about the championship, particularly this year. I suppose it's growing year by year. You know, and this seems to be a real solid proposal, well thought out. And, you know, the GPA are now a very, very formidable body within the association. So I think they're going to have to look at it. But I would say one thing in particular. I think it'll probably definitely be the end of the dual player, because if there's that many games for involved in football and three different championships, I think the hurler and footballer just won't work anymore.
Okay, yeah. No, absolutely. Listen, thank you both for your time this evening. Jens appreciate it. Jack Nolan and John Casey. We'll talk to you soon. Thanks a lot.
Okay, you.
Cheers, John and Jack there. Yeah, interesting stuff. What do you think, Gary? I mean, I have to say, it's a very exciting format because it's new, and this is maybe something that the GAA need to weigh up. You know, anything that's new is automatically, oh, great, great, but it remains to be seen whether they'll actually take this seriously or not.
I think they have to take it seriously. If you look at the situation in Mayo, the player power there is probably going to get rid of a management team, and I guess the players, if they wish, if they feel strongly enough about it, can just down tools as well. But I think there's a huge appetite to see more inter-county action, and for more counties to be involved a little bit longer, and protect what's so important as the club scene. The clubs have to play more. Can't be playing county finals in November and that sort of rubbish. And I think the Patrick's Day All-Ireland Inter-Club needs to be changed dramatically as well. So there's an appetite for change. It's just whether the powers that be in Croke Park have the courage to do it.
You see, and equally, you just want more exciting games, don't you? You just want more exciting games with so much at stake. And we just don't get that until, realistically, maybe the quarterfinals, but mostly just the semifinals in the last few years.
Oh, undoubtedly. I mean, you look at even the hurling, even the football this year. There was a little bit in the football, maybe Tyrone here or there. But, you know, realistically, we kind of knew what was going to happen or who was going to be there. So we need to see them locking horns earlier and find out what happens. And hopefully the more games will bring on other counties.
Okay, 51552 for your text messages at GameOn2FM on Twitter.
It's a difficult thing. Obviously we're a little bit biased. Jimmy Mullen and Paul Dunn, to go out today, step up on the tee box and shoot 8 under par in your first professional round, it's a huge achievement. It's something to be able to say, well, my first ever tournament, I went out and shot 64 and beat all the pros. That's not a bad thing, is it?
It's remarkable, really. And the two of them, you know, they got through their first stage of qualifying as well, so they couldn't really have hit the ground running any better than they have. And it'll be, as I thought it would be, it'll be just fascinating to see how this weekend plays out, because the fact that, and it's funny, and it's an issue that I had with for years on tour with the currency exchange, the fact that the dollar is so strong at the moment, and this event is a US dollar event, even though it's been played in the UK, the prize money, it's over 700 grand on offer for the winner. But what it means more than anything is the breakdown is a lot bigger. So, for someone like Peter Lawrie had a great start today, 5 under. He probably needs a top 20 this week to keep him his card. And obviously for Paul, Paul has to keep going with the heroics he's doing. He needs a top 3 to get his card, which Rory didn't know 7. And, we've seen what's happened since then. So maybe, hopefully, because we have to dream. There's nothing in the rules to say you can't dream. Hopefully we do have a potential superstar.
The average scoring today, Kings Barnes 70.2, St Andrews 71.9, and Carnoustie 72.45. So Carnoustie the toughest by a long way.
Yeah, and this tournament can depend dramatically on the draw. I think Paul's going to play St Andrews tomorrow, and then Carnoustie on Saturday, and the cut's made after 3 rounds. But if the weather does, the forecast is good, but it's changeable, anything can happen. But if the course you don't want really to be on when the weather's bad is Carnoustie.
Okay.
And all the, the TV pairings, all the superstars played Carnoustie today. They'll play Kings Barnes tomorrow and then St Andrews on Saturday. And if they make the cut, they play St Andrews on Saturday. So that's the advantage of having a marquee draw. Whereas the guys, you could play, because there's a big difference in the greens. Carnoustie are much smoother and quicker. And then you get back on to the other two, which are a little different. But it's an amazing start from Paul Dunn. And his love affair with that neck of the woods.
Absolutely.
Really.
I was watching some of the celebrities today playing as well. What's the deal there? Do they all just play? Is it just it's a celebrity plus a professional golfer? Is that across the board?
Yeah, well, they used to. They used to play with the same guy for 3 days, and now they mix the same pairing for 3 days, and now they mix it around. So you'll play with the same guy, but you'll play with different guys, same amateur, but you'll have different pairings for the 3 days. And it. Hugely important on the draw you get to, because the rounds are really long. It's almost a 6-hour round. And if you're out with some
hacker like me,
well, no, but at least you'd have a bit of crack with you. You can be out with a hacker,
be drunk,
which you obviously are, but you can be out with some guy who is a hacker and takes it really seriously. And Johan Rupert, the guy that runs and owns the event, he's a rule: if you're more than 2 shots outside of scoring on a
hole,
you have to pick it up.
Okay.
If you don't, you're off.
Okay.
So just to speed things up.
Yeah, great.
Because it's a fabulous week.
Is it though? But yeah, because that was my next question. I was wondering, do the pros actually, is it a bit of an inconvenience playing with these guys, or do they actually enjoy it because it's a bit of fun?
There's two sides. You can say it's a major distraction for playing such a, crazy amount of money that could potentially change your season, because St Andrews is quite a dangerous golf course to play, because it's in and out,
a lot of crossing
and fairways.
Yeah.
Obviously the amateurs don't play as well as the pros. They don't know where they're going to hit it, so it can be a long event. But I think the guys that you take it for what it is, you embrace it. Considering the weather that they're having at the moment, there is no nicer place on the planet to play a tour event.
Yeah, Graham McDowell going pretty well, 4 under par. He's had an awful season. I wonder about him. I wonder, is he ever going to get back to anywhere near the heights that he was? And maybe. He has spoken about the influence that his family has had on him now that he's a dad, and that his priorities have been all over the place.
Yeah, well, there are the challenges of being, living on the road, being away for 25, 30 weeks. It's fine and easy to do it when you're young, free and single. But, there's other challenges when you get married and kids come along, and it can be demanding. And, the relationship is hugely important. The women have to, sacrifice a lot. Okay, financially, they probably have loads, but... It's a challenge, and you have to be very selfish to get to the top of the game, and more selfish perhaps to stay at the top of the game. And maybe Graham is just trying to, I hope he identifies with those challenges rather than he's struggling a bit with his game and he starts trying to change his swing and stuff like that. Because when you get to his age and what he's achieved, it's, you know, his swing is a swing.
Yeah.
You're not going to... I think we can see that with Porrick. I mean, Porrick has flittered around so much with his swing, and then you kind of never really know, you know, where your old swing was. And so I hope he identifies that. And, you know, because he's shown good form last week. He started brightly in the European Open. He started brightly today. And, you know, he's a world-class player.
Yeah.
And it's, you would hope with guys like him, it's just a flick of a switch and he can get back on the winning trail pretty soon.
Shane Lowry's had a few weeks out. Obviously, he enjoyed himself because he was at Croke Park. I think more than he was in his own house. But he's a huge JA fan. Yeah. And look, it's coming back after a six-week break like that, it's difficult, I suppose.
It is difficult, and he was in Carnoustie today, which is the toughest of the three. And, you know, it's easy to get away from you around there. And but, you know, he's a big chance at King's Barnes tomorrow. He can
go very low,
knock around there and 500-600 and asleep. And decent day in St Andrews and he's back in there.
Yeah, okay. I just want to ask you, because a lot of people will be familiar with Clodagh Coghlan and what happened in Berkeley, and there's a big day fundraiser for her tomorrow. You're involved in that.
Yeah, big day at the Castle Golf Club tomorrow. All the guys in Danu and the members of the Castle and the people that are friendly with the Coghlan family, they're going to run a charity day tomorrow and hopefully raise as much money as possible.
Yeah, and Beat the Pro is on, some hacker there who they've signed up to.
The problem is, there's 148 guys playing and I'm just hoping they don't all beat me. So,
yeah, well, it's for a brilliant cause, as I said.
And it's good prize and offer as well, because the people that beat me go into a draw to win a Shane Lowry driver.
Oh, really? Okay, yeah. Very good. Yeah. Excellent stuff. That's tomorrow. So, obviously, we wish everyone involved with that the best of luck. Any scores tonight so far in the Europa League, you were telling me earlier on?
Yeah, Spurs and Monaco are one each. And sorry, I forgot, Gavin Moynihan's doing fantastically well in Portugal.
Yeah.
He's got the final round
second
tomorrow.
68 in a row?
Yeah, he's at first stage. And Michael McGeady is doing well also in Hardy-Low in France. Owner of the course record around there, I'll just throw that in.
What did you shoot?
62.
Ooh, very nice. Very
8
nice.
Under after 11. Saw 59 in my sights and choked like a pig.
Jeff Shepherd, how are you?
I'm doing fine.
Apropos of nothing there, I wasn't trying to, you know, confuse you with choking like a pig, but in terms of pigs, the NFL are acting all weird again with relation to Tom Brady. They won't let this go. This suspension, they've filed for an appeal and it looks like they're going to go all the way to the court, is that right?
Well, yeah, now they're talking about, you know, pushing it into February of 2016, like 4 days before the Super Bowl. I mean, what do they get out of this? I don't understand.
So, bad publicity, for one thing.
Sure, yeah, and I mean, you know, everybody is just so sick and tired of talking about this, especially, you know, it's one thing if it's the summer and it's the off season and, you know, whatever, there's no games. But I mean, you know, we're heading into week four now. So no one is interested in talking about this stuff still. Everybody's wanted to, you know, concentrate on football, and it's just dragging on forever.
Okay, well, have a listen to this. This is Ronda Rousey. If you don't know who she is, she's probably one of the best fighters in the UFC at the moment, male or female. Have a listen to this.
I was around 14 years old and I thought I was hot shit badass, right? And I felt like, you know, the secret blonde kind of Beverly Hills ninja. And I loved Frappuccinos. So me and my friend Jackie, after school, we would walk over to the promenade. And Jackie was like my Paul Heyman, you know. She would be like, I bet my girl right here could beat you up for $10 or $5 or whatever. And then some guy would be like, eh, whatever, I'll take that bet. It would just start, whatever the guy was, I'd throw him to the ground, I would either get him a choke or an arm bar, and we would get him to say that he gave up and take his money and go buy Frappuccinos. And, yeah, those were my first pro fights. We'll fight for Frappuccinos.
Well, there you go. If you wondered how Ronda Rousey made her name, Jeff, it was beating up guys when she was 14 years of age for a coffee.
You know, if you hated shopping before, imagine what you would imagine how you would feel after you went to the mall, you know, and got beat up by a teenage girl. You know,
I never thought of it like that. Oh man, yeah, and I have to say, yeah, she's an incredible athlete, but I mean that does explain why she's such a badass and nobody can beat her. 14 years of age.
Right, she's been beating up guys for a decade.
Yeah, exactly.
Amazing. It really is amazing. I mean, Americans can't get enough of her. I mean, it's just she's in commercials now. I mean, she's all over the place. She was in the Entourage movie. I mean, she is a full-on superstar. You know, I mean, they cannot get enough of her. And even if they could, she'd beat him up.
Yeah, I'd love to see her fight Floyd Mayweather. I've said this before. I want to see her kick the living head off Floyd Mayweather. I'd just love to see that.
She's not shy about wanting to get in the ring with him too. I just don't know if they're going to make it happen.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think he'd be running scared. There's a pretty unlucky team at the moment over there, UCF. That are on a bad losing streak. But the good side is for their fans that you can go and watch them and drink for free. Is that right?
Yeah, so it's University of Central Florida. It's down in Orlando, Florida. And they started out the year with 0-4. A couple of normal losses and a couple of really bad ones. Well, they're playing Tulane, which is a school out of New Orleans, my hometown, this weekend. And there's a certain bar has said, from now on, you will get free beer during all UCF games until they win. So, you know, your typical college football game lasts, you know, three and a half hours, depending on how many commercials. So, I mean, you know, you could put down a couple of pints or you know, 15 or so in 3 hours.
Yeah.
So, that's a great advertisement for the bar.
Game on.
Game on.
2FM.